Epilogue. Laurent. We woke to a lot of news on the second day of publication, much of it generated by the Pegasus Project rollout, some of it not. Not all of the news was good, especially a story out of Casablanca that morning. Omar Radi had been convicted of undermining the internal security of the state, and of rape, and sentenced to 6 years in prison. Omar continued to declare his innocence. His family and supporters to cry to the Moroccan court's obstruction of any credible defense and to the prosecution's flimsy evidence. After more than a year in jail while the legal proceedings ground their way to their inevitable conclusion, Omar was already in declining health and often despondent. It was hard to imagine him emerging unbroken after another 6 years in prison. And this was clearly what King Mohammed VI and his coterie were counting on. Omar was not merely being silenced. He was being held up as an example of what could happen to anybody who might attempt the practice of independent journalism in Morocco, anyone lacking due respect to the king. Omar was being supported by journalism foundations and civil society NGOs whose members were at a safe remove from the Kingdom of Morocco, but there was no serious protest made by any government anywhere. The U.S. Secretary of State had reportedly raised general concerns with Moroccan government officials about the kingdom's poor performance on human rights and press freedom several weeks earlier, but nobody was divulging what was said behind closed doors. It reminded me of what Khadija Ismailova had said after one of her arrests in Baku. Either stand up and defend freedom of the press and the right of privacy allowed in public, or don't bother. I don't want any private diplomacy for my case, she had said back in 2015. People of my country need to know that human rights are supported. Backlash against the Pegasus Project itself came from the expected parties that week, with Shalev in the lead. He was conciliatory at times. The company cares about journalists and activists and civil society in general, he said in interviews. If somebody says I found a better way to get criminals, get terrorists, get information from a pedophile, I will shut down Pegasus completely. He hammered on his talking points. NSO is a software company and doesn't operate Pegasus. The company sells to government entities only. It has no real-time visibility into its clients' targets. The Israeli government regulates all licenses of the Pegasus system. But as media outlets all over the world ran with and followed up on the stories our consortium published over the next 4 days, and it was clear the investigation was going to have real impact, the response from NSO grew angrier and more conspiratorial. Shalev said the list of numbers had no relation to NSO, and the number of selections on the list was insane. He said our forensics were all wrong, but did not point to a single actual error in the detailed reports that the security lab had provided the company. 3 days into publication, NSO threw up its hands and emailed a statement to media organizations across the world. Enough is enough. In light of the recent planned and well-orchestrated media campaign led by Forbidden Stories and pushed by special interest groups, and due to the complete disregard of the facts, NSO is announcing it will no longer be responding to media inquiries on this matter. NSO and its defenders had by then opened its playbook to a dog-eared, oft-used page. Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International were either leaders of, or tools of, an anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic conspiracy, they suggested. One Israeli army reservist and cyber specialist told reporters that the Pegasus Project was an orchestrated effort to harm Israel by smearing one of its cyber companies. The deliberate hand, as Shalev called it, might be the pro-Palestinian BDS movement. Boycott, divestment, sanctions, or Qatar. Al Jazeera, I noticed, gave much attention to the Pegasus Project reports, said one Israeli professor. I'm sure the Ministry of Defense knows exactly who's behind it. Sandrine was at the office early on the morning after NSO's Enough is Enough diatribe and received a courier delivering an official document from the Moroccan ambassador in Paris. The delivery man was an amiable and easygoing sort. The document he was carrying was not. The Kingdom of Morocco was suing me for defamation. I had been sued for defamation by a foreign government before, and knew that the Kingdom of Morocco, like the Republic of Azerbaijan, had no real case. But the lawsuit was not the point. The point was the free publicity generated by the news that the case had been filed and was headed to trial. This was just part of a public relations campaign Morocco was mounting in the face of the embarrassing revelations about its use of spyware. The kingdom had already denied its use of Pegasus against anyone, and now it was unleashing its paid agents to destroy the messengers. Morocco's lawyer in France filed defamation suits against Le Monde, Mediapart, Radio France, and later, L'Humanité. The kingdom also filed an injunction against Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany. The kingdom's subsidized media mouthpieces went after Sandrine and me personally, without ever addressing the specifics of Morocco's cyber surveillance program that we had helped to reveal. I was, in this telling, a money-hungry mountebank, obsessed with Morocco, financed by George Soros's Open Society. Which is true, in part, and I am proud of it. Whose aim is to finance projects to destabilize Arab countries. Which is a lie. The kingdom's lawyer in Paris granted interviews to a slew of media organizations and attacked me, Forbidden Stories, the consortium, and our reporting because, as he said, the Moroccan state wants all possible light cast on these false allegations. The kingdom did have good reason to kick up some dust. The morning I was served with legal papers, President Emmanuel Macron, who had just been alerted that he and many of his ministers were among the people on our list, called an urgent national security meeting. Prosecutors in Paris were already investigating possible criminal activity in France by Moroccan authorities. Our phones didn't stop ringing that first week, and many of the callers had the same frantic request. Please check for me. Was my phone number on the list? The French government and the French prosecutors were determined to get a look at the list itself, and the police sent a single officer over to make the case to me in person. I agreed to meet him outside a cafe near the Gare de Lyon, and he pulled up on a motorbike full of bon ami. He made some small talk about biking in Paris. He told me he had read the Pegasus Project in full and found it enlightening. He said we were on the same team. Then he made his pitch for why I should hand over our list to the French government. He said we were both looking out for victims and potential victims. All these people, he said, don't you want to protect them? The talk remained friendly, even when I explained that we were journalists and not government agents. We had done our part by alerting the world to the dangers of Pegasus. But this was not our list to hand over, and we had made a pledge not to reveal our source, who was still in danger. The police officer said he understood the ethics of journalism, of course, and he was sympathetic to our professional obligation to protect our source. But he warned me that if I didn't cooperate, French law enforcement would probably get a subpoena commanding me to hand over the list, or a search warrant to seize it. I kind of felt bad for him, since they sent him alone and he had to play both good cop and bad cop. He wanted me to understand all the pressure he was under from the prosecutor. There were a lot of important people on that list. Couldn't we help out? Wasn't it our patriotic duty? He pushed for a while, but when it became clear I wasn't going to budge, he reverted back to good cop. He said he understood our position, and he agreed it was proper. If the prosecutor really did try to get a subpoena or a search warrant, he told me he would stand up for us. Before he departed, he asked the question I knew was coming. Could you check a few numbers for me? See if they were on the list? I received the subpoena the next day, and later a message from the cop who told me he was really upset that we didn't want to protect the victims. If I didn't comply with the subpoena and hand over the lists, things would escalate. We're not far from getting a search warrant, he said. I thought you said you would defend us, I answered. In the end, we were not compelled by law enforcement to hand over the list, and prosecutors didn't even try to get a search warrant. But I was able to do a favor for one very high-up French government official who was closely following the case. He wanted me to check a small set of numbers against our list. The numbers he gave me had only 6 digits, not the usual 10, which meant they would be unidentifiable to me. I agreed to check for him, but only because I was hoping he would do the honorable thing and reveal the names to Forbidden Stories for eventual publication. It seemed pretty obvious that these were numbers of French officials whose phones had showed evidence of spyware infection after the government did its own forensic analysis. Some were on the list, I was able to tell him later, and some were not. It's worse than I thought, he said when I gave him the news. Do you have positive results for ministers that we did not mention? I asked. He said yes. I've started to ask myself, he said cryptically, if there are any who have escaped. Official confirmations of Pegasus attacks that we had reported, or brand new confirmations of previously unknown attacks, started coming out in the first weeks after our publication and continue to come out to this day. Reporting threads we had started were being picked up by other media organizations around the world. We felt like this story was not going to fade away anytime soon. Forensics by the National Cybersecurity Agency of France, ANSSI, supported Claudio and Danica's findings on Edoui Plenel and Lénaigue Bredot, and added a journalist from France 24 Television to the list of Pegasus victims. Mediapart later broke the story that ANSSI also confirmed the presence of suspicious markers in the phones of five French government ministers. ANSSI would eventually confirm almost all the French citizens we identified as victims, and more we had not. The security lab turned up evidence that a British lawyer defending an Emirati princess had suffered a Pegasus attack. Court papers released in London in early October revealed that the Emir of Dubai had likely used Pegasus to spy on his estranged wife, her famous divorce attorney, a member of parliament, and a few others in the royal wife's entourage. A Dublin-based NGO caught Israel using Pegasus to spy on six Palestinian human rights activists. Citizen Lab and the Security Lab both confirmed those findings separately. The Israeli government had conveniently designated the workplaces of three of the victims as terrorist organizations a few weeks before the report, but long after they had conducted their warrantless surveillance. Thanks to Carmen Aristegui and her informant, Mexico arrested a former employee of Yuri Ansbacher in early November 2021 and charged him with using Pegasus to spy on at least one journalist, Carmen herself. This was the first known instance of a private company using Pegasus to spy on a private citizen, which is apparently what can happen when nobody in the country controls the use and spread of this military-grade cyber weaponry. But the Mexican government was promising transparency now and had already begun releasing startling details to the public. Last week, the government's top anti-money laundering investigator said officials from the previous Mexican administrations had spent about $300 million in government money to purchase spyware, the Associated Press reported. The head of Mexico's financial intelligence unit said the bills for programs like Pegasus spyware appear to have included excess payments that may have been channeled back to government officials as kickbacks. The Polish government was found to have used Pegasus to spy on its political opponents, and so too the Spanish government, which put these two in league with Mexico, Hungary, and India, to name a few. Apple started playing a little offense. The company patched the Megalodon exploit chain that Claudio and Danica had discovered, and that Citizen Lab had actually then captured. Apple then went to work engineering a lockdown mode to safeguard its new iPhones, iPads, and computers from surreptitious spyware attacks. The company also filed a lawsuit against NSO at the end of November 2021, calling the company immoral 21st century mercenaries. NSO's malicious activities have exploited Apple's products, injured Apple's users, and damaged Apple's business and goodwill. NSO's malicious products and services have also required Apple to devote thousands of hours to investigate the attacks, identify the harm, diagnose the extent of the impact and exploitation, and develop and deploy the necessary repairs and patches to ensure that Apple servers, products, platforms, applications, and experiences remain safe and secure for more than a billion individuals and entities. Apple also announced a new policy of proactively alerting its iPhone users when they had been attacked by cyber surveillance weapons, then immediately revealed that 11 employees at the United States Embassy in Uganda had been hacked by Pegasus. The names of active iMessage exploit accounts the security lab had shared with Apple, the company text told Danica, had been foundational in its ability to track NSO spyware and send out accurate notifications. The United States government may have already known of the hack in Uganda because it had by then blacklisted NSO, which made it nearly impossible for the company to buy crucial technology from Dell, Intel, Cisco, and Microsoft. This was an unprecedented step. The U.S. had, without warning, cut off from all trade a private company in an allied country. The United States, said Commerce Secretary Gina M. Raimondo, is committed to aggressively using export controls to hold companies accountable that develop, traffic, or use technologies to conduct malicious activities that threaten the cybersecurity of members of civil society, dissidents, government officials, and organizations here and abroad. November 2021, 4 months after our publication, was when NSO began taking on serious water, and without properly functioning bilge pumps. The man who agreed to come in and right the NSO ship fled a week after news of the blacklisting, before his official start date. In light of special circumstances that have arisen, Isaac Benvenisti wrote to the NSO board, he would not be able to assume the position of CEO with the company. Novopina, the private equity company that had become majority owners in 2019, had collapsed in on itself, and a new set of consultants were now looking after the interests of shareholders invested in NSO. The Employee Pension Fund of the state of Oregon, for instance, was understandably shaky about continuing its large equity position in what the U.S. government called a tool of transnational repression. NSO employees soldiered on and kept up a good show. We save lives. They could point to their invitation to the company-wide Hanukkah retreat Shalev was throwing at a Red Sea beach resort as a sure sign that NSO would endure. But software coders and engineers in Tel Aviv were swapping stories of NSO employees going sheepishly silent when asked to recount their work week at Shabbat family dinners on Friday night. Sales of Pegasus slowed to a trickle, and Moody's pronounced the company in danger of defaulting on its debt. There was some doubt that NSO could make its November 2021 payroll. Thanks to some excellent reporting by the Financial Times, we know what was happening inside NSO at that dire moment. Shalev boldly announced a new plan to boost revenue, start selling to those elevated risk customers again. NSO's new financial minders at the Berkeley Research Group were understandably alarmed. BRG hadn't even received necessary security clearances from the Israel government, so it had no real vision into the arms export sales that NSO specialized in. You are demanding that BRG blindly sanctions the sale of Pegasus to elevated risk customers without a thorough governance review? Read a letter the Financial Times reporters saw. Please note that in no circumstances is BRG prepared to do so. Shalev was in a full snit. When BRG insisted that the plan was fraught with risk, according to the Financial Times, Shalev quipped back that it was risky to miss a debt payment too. The best Shalev could get out of BRG was a $10 million loan that helped to cover the payroll for a time. He has since concocted something NSO insiders call the Phoenix Plan. NSO could split off all the ugly liabilities inside the company's Pegasus system and sell them on the open market, maybe even to a U.S. defense contractor. By the middle of 2022, it was pretty clear that NSO was not going to rise from the ashes. The company had ridden its signature product, Pegasus, to the top of the mountain, but the wings on the stalking horse appeared to be irreparably broken. Julio keeps telling everybody that the company is on the verge of a turnaround, the Financial Times quoted one Israeli official. It is not. The demise of NSO is a cautionary tale for the current traffickers of these military-grade cyber weapons and the wannabe traffickers. But it is also a cautionary tale for all the spyware critics and the human rights defenders who hope to forestall the Orwellian future where cyber surveillance is a baked-in fact of our civic life. NSO might be crippled, but the technology it engineered is not. The issues of protecting privacy and freedom of expression and freedom of the press might have been raised, but the solutions are not even in the works. A dozen or so governments around the world held hearings and commenced investigations and convened courts of law to get to the bottom of the problem of unwarranted cyber surveillance and make recommendations for solving it. There has been a surfeit of official lip-flapping in the 18 months since the publication of the Pegasus Project and very little actual regulation. The truth is, in terms of legal restrictions, the cyber surveillance industry still operates without any real guardrails. Oh, and NSO might not live to fight another day, but there are plenty more private spyware companies out there. The UAE has created its own in-house spyware monster, Dark Matter, thanks to help from coders and engineers they hired away from NSO, and from some mercenary former agents from the world's premier signals intelligence organization, the United States' National Security Agency. Finally, it is worth recognizing that while the for-profit intrusion as a service industry might see the need to be more careful after all the unsightly press of the past few years, the clients of that industry do not share that need for caution. Why would they? I have not seen a single instance of a democratic government crying shame on the regimes who used Pegasus for years as a tool of vicious repression against their own citizens. The worst of them, Azerbaijan, the UAE, Morocco, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, have suffered little to no consequences. Consider this story of the CEO of a private company specializing in cybersecurity. His company does not traffic in spyware, but they have the coding and engineering talent to do it, and everybody in the market knows that. He has been courted for years by Middle Eastern potentates who fly him on private jets to their capital cities and offer him tens of millions of dollars to provide them with cyber surveillance tools on par with Pegasus. He has always said no. But he told us things have changed in the wake of our investigation, when NSO could no longer license its wares in Bahrain, the UAE, Saudi Arabia. The effect he described was not what I expected. If you want to understand what happens because of the Pegasus project, he told us last year, like 4 months ago, Saudi Arabia came to us and offered us $200 million. He turned them down again and says he will continue to do so, but one deal for 2 years, I get $200 million, he says. So now you understand the economics of this industry.